You're looking at Psalm 36. Psalm 36. Our summary statement for Psalm 36. Psalm 36 praises God's inexhaustible and priceless covenant mercy toward those who love Him. We'll go over that again. Psalm 36 praises God's inexhaustible and priceless covenant mercy toward those who love Him. Simple outline for Psalm 36 would be in three parts. Verses 1 to 4, the folly of the wicked. Verses 5 to 9, the security of God's covenant mercy. Verses 10 to 12, prayer for deliverance. Go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 4, the folly of the wicked. Verses 5 to 9, the security of God's covenant mercy. Verses 10 to 12, prayer for deliverance. All right, so we'll go to our observations for Psalm 36. It was written by David, as you can see in the superscription, to the chief musician, a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord. There's no occasion mentioned in the superscription, and the psalm is directed toward the chief musician or to the choir master. David is addressed, named in the superscription, and he is addressed for the second and final time in the Psalms as the servant of Yahweh. That first appears in Psalm 18. This is the second appearance of that, and there are no more in the Psalms. We talked a bit about the servant of Yahweh before. It is a title that is most often applied to Moses when you look back into the books of the law. But when you look in the books of the prophets, it is a title that is applied to the Messiah, particularly in Isaiah and Isaiah's section of what is sometimes called the servant songs, the servant of Yahweh. So it is a messianic title, prophetic messianic title, and here attributed to David as it was in Psalm 18. Psalm 36 is what we would just call in a general category a prayer psalm. It has elements of different psalm types in it, but no one really that is dominant. It obviously has wisdom, Torah instruction elements in it. This comes in particular because we see the righteous and the wicked. We see a contrast of them. We see their ways. We see a reference to wisdom in the psalm. So it does have several of those elements. It also has some elements of a creation psalm when you start talking about the heavens and the earth and all those sorts of things. It definitely has elements of a praise psalm. You have a section in the psalm that is sort of a catalog of praise for Yahweh and His covenant mercy. And it also has some elements of petition and sort of like lament. It's not doesn't have a lot of the conventions of lament, but it does have some and has definitely a prayer of petition for deliverance. When it comes to the poetic features for Psalm 36, there is some imagery in the psalm, particularly in the praise section in verses 5 to 9, where we have a lot of imagery that's used. Particularly, David here uses extremes, references to extremes in order to capture the whole. So, for instance, if we said something like, I went through the whole thing from A to Z, you know, we're using the extremes to say that we comprehended the whole. And that's what this psalm does with heights and depths and things like that. There are also images of feasting and drinking and abundance that describes God's covenant blessings. And so it does have some language of good imagery like that. Okay, so let's walk through this psalm. It's a shorter one than the previous couple that we have looked at, 12 verses. The transgression of the wicked saith within my heart, that there is no fear of God before his eyes. For he flattereth himself in his own eyes, until his iniquity be found to be hateful. The words of his mouth are iniquity and deceit. He hath left off to be wise and to do good. He deviseth mischief upon his bed. He setteth himself in a way that is not good. He abhorreth not evil. Thy mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens, and thy faithfulness reacheth unto the clouds. Thy righteousness is like the great mountains. Thy judgments are a great deep. O Lord, thou preservest man and beast. How excellent is thy loving kindness, O God! Therefore the children of men put their trust under the shadow of thy wings. They shall be abundantly satisfied with the fatness of thy house, and thou shalt make them drink of the river of thy pleasures. For with thee is the fountain of life. In thy light shall we see light. O continue thy loving kindness unto them that know thee, and thy righteousness to the upright in heart. Let not the foot of pride come against me, and let not the hand of the wicked remove me. There are the workers of iniquity fallen. They are cast down and shall not be able to rise. So this psalm begins verses 1 to 4 and begins particularly in verse 1, speaking an oracle of the ways of the wicked. And the word for the word that says saith there, the transgression of the wicked saith within my heart, is a word that is oftentimes translated as oracle, or it definitely has that indication. It's used a lot of times in connection with a prophetic utterance. So this is something that is some sort of revelation that has been given. So it's some revelation that has been given and is spoken as a prophetic utterance. So that is how that this psalm is characterized. It's an oracle spoken within the heart of the psalmist David. He mentions that there's no fear of God before the eyes of the wicked. And no fear of God actually marks the beginning of their problems, which progress to worse by verse 4. So you do have movement in verses 1 to 4. You have a decline. The wicked begin with no fear of God, and they end in verse 4 with setting themselves in the way that's not good and refusing to abhor or hate evil. Now, the word for fear that's used here is a word that means dread or terror. It's not the word that oftentimes is used that would indicate more of the reverential type of fear. It does, in fact, we could say that they're not afraid of God. The wicked, within their own heart, within their own mind, deep within them, in other words, in the core of their being, they are not afraid of God. It indicates fearfulness of God's punishing judgments. And those that sort of fearfulness should motivate men and women to repent and to trust in God. But with the wicked that he's speaking of, there is no fear of God before their eyes. Now, Paul quoted the last line of verse 1 in Romans chapter 3 and verse number 18. And if you recall, in Romans 3, when we went through that, he was arguing the universal sinfulness of all men, Jews and Gentiles alike. And so he quoted from this verse, there being no fear of God before his eyes. No fear of God, as it progresses into the next verse, no fear of God then leads to all these developments. He doesn't heed God's counsels. So he doesn't listen to God's commands, to God's warnings. And so, in essence, the wicked becomes his own counselor. He becomes his own teacher, his own instructor, and his own guide in the way that he ought to go. And quite frankly, what we see in verse 2 is that he is blinded by his own arrogance. And because of his arrogance, he flatters himself, which is something we have seen before in reference to the wicked, particularly in Psalm 5 and verse 9. But he has blinded himself with his flattery. And the last phrase is a little little difficult grammatically, but the sense of it is that he can't discern his own iniquity. So in other words, he's blinded himself through his own self-flattery that he does not see sin within himself. He doesn't see any evil there. He doesn't see anything that needs to be repented of. He doesn't see anything that would cause him to fear God's judgment. As we proceed, we see that, again, this progression continues. The words of his mouth are iniquity and deceit and so on. Not only is he blinded by his pride, but the wicked is also self-deceived. It's sort of like that old saying, who is it that the man who defends himself has a fool for a client or something like that. I don't remember how that saying goes. Steve probably knows it right off. I probably messed it up. But he has deceived himself by his own flattery and his own counsel. And so he believes that his own thoughts and words are right. These aren't the words of God. These aren't the words that have come from heaven. These are the words of his own heart and his own mind. And he believes them to be right because he has deceived himself. And he tells us here that he's left off to be wise. He has forsaken wisdom. Now, the word for wise that's used here is one of the real common words in Proverbs that is used for wisdom. It's a word that means skillful or even in a sense of successful, doing something well. This wisdom, he's left off to be wise. The same word is also used in Psalm 2 and verse number 10, where the nations that are rebelling against God and against his anointed son are told to be wise. And that means humbling themselves and submitting themselves to his son before he becomes angry. It is the wisdom that God also did not find when he was looking down on the earth upon the children of men in Psalm 14 and verse number 2. So he has forsaken wisdom because there's no fear of God. He's flattered himself in his pride. He's deceived himself. He believes his own thoughts and intentions to be right. And then we get to the final step that he mentions in this progression, and that's in verse 4, to where this wicked man maximizes his time to do evil. So even while he is in bed, while he is at rest, it says that he's plotting evil. That mind is turning and is imagining and devising wicked things. And the plotting of evil by the wicked is something that has been shown to be characteristic of the wicked in Psalm 10, verse 2, Psalm 21, verse 11, Psalm 35 a couple times, actually, verse 4 and verse 20. And it says here that he sets himself, which is a word that means that he fixes himself. He stations himself to do evil or to go in a way that is not good. And ultimately, he abhors not or he does not hate evil, which is what we are told in Proverbs chapter number 8 and verse number 13. In Proverbs chapter 8, verse 13, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogancy and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate. This is the way of wisdom that is shown to us. It's to hate the way of evil. Now, the meditation in these first four verses on the way of the wicked is actually opposite the instruction of the law. So if you think back to like Deuteronomy chapter 6 in the first 9 verses there, and what you see is instruction that is given to, first of all, start with the fear of the Lord, and then it is to be constantly speaking his word, his law, to be meditating it, speaking it, continually when he sits down, when he rises up. Well, here the wicked man has words of falsehood, words of deceit, words of flattery that are on his mouth, even when he's lying in his bed, even when he's going in the way. So it's the opposite of what that instruction is. And it's also in a direct contrast to the way of the righteous or the blessed man in Psalm 1. He doesn't go in the counsel of the ungodly. He delights the law of the Lord, meditates in it day and night, and so on. Then we come to verses 5 to 9, And we get a contrast in these verses with the way of the wicked and the way of God's covenant mercy. Now, we might be expecting, as we come to verses 5 to 9, he's given us this meditation on the folly of the wicked. And we might be expecting the contrast is going to be then with the way of the righteous. But it's not exactly the way that David does it. He actually more meditates on God's covenant faithfulness, contrasting that with the way of the wicked, and then showing the righteous or the upright as the beneficiaries, as those that receive the blessing of God's faithfulness to his own covenant. Now, obviously, mercy that is here in verse 5 is the Hebrew word hesed, and it occurs in verse 7 and verse 10 also, so it is used three times in this psalm. It is a word that we've talked about before. Sometimes it's translated loving kindness. I think it's in the other two verses. Sometimes it's been translated as steadfast love and other sorts of ways. And it is a word that we've seen associated with God's covenant faithfulness. There's a thought of love and of kindness and of mercy, but in all of that, there's a thought of loyalty in it, that God is loyal to his covenant. So those who are in covenant relationship with him, he is kind and merciful to, loyally, to his word. Now, this is the section where he begins to use these different extremes. The mercy of the Lord's in the heavens and his faithfulness reaching under the clouds, his righteousness like great mountains and judgments are a great deep. So he's using these various extremes, and he's giving us a picture of God's covenant mercy that is comprehensive and it's inexhaustible. It covers all of this area. So one consequence would be that there are none that are beyond the reach of God's covenant mercy. So there are no men upon the earth that are beyond the reach of God's covenant mercy. It covers the earth. It covers this creation. He also uses terms that are often associated with God's covenant, mercy, faithfulness, righteousness, and judgment. And we see all four of those terms being used here as well. These are robust terms that indicate truth, goodness, and beauty. In other words, a God's providence that is like him. In other words, his reign and his rule and his governing of his creation. And so these are terms that don't characterize the present evil world, but they do characterize the sovereign God over the world. They do characterize the world that is to come. It's also stated here that he preserves man and beast. And the word for preserve means to save or deliver. It's oftentimes translated as save. We've seen it translated that way a number of times already in the Psalms. But man and beast further extends God's mercies. And it indicates his purpose to redeem creation as well as people who trust in him. So if you think of a section like Romans chapter 8, verses 19 to 22, where Paul links together the redemption of the bodies of the saved along with the redemption of the creation, that he says all are groaning and travailing together now in pain and in expectation, and they're awaiting that redemption. So this psalm is a psalm that speaks of God's purpose in that expansive way. It's not merely just to redeem men, but to redeem his creation as well. We have this phrase excellent, or the word excellent in verse 7, spoken of God's hesed, his loving kindness as excellent. And you could think of that word as indicating excelling in value or excelling in worth. It's priceless, God's covenant mercy. And because of that, he says, the children of men, or the Beni Hadam, the sons of Adam, put their trust under the shadow of thy wings. So the sons of Adam take refuge, and that's what the word for trust there means. It's used several times. We've seen it in Psalm 212 5:11, Psalm 7, verse 1, and a lot of other references, a common word we've seen associated with that covenant trust, that taking refuge in God. And this is another image that is used here, the shadow of thy wings. And it's an image of God's protection and security, like that of a mother bird that is protecting her brood. And we see this same image used in Psalm 17 and verse number 8. And the safety and the security of the wings turns by the next verse, in verse number 8, to the abundant provision and satisfaction in God's house. So then we go to the eating and drinking and the being satisfied. It gives us a sensory description, much like Psalm 34 that speaks, you know, taste and see that the Lord is good. But this eating and drinking is like that is depicted in Psalm 23, that table that is prepared in the presence of the enemies. And it also reminds us of the wisdom feast, in Proverbs chapter 9 and verses 1 to 5. He refers to God as, or with him as, the fountain of life in verse number 9. So fountain of life is water of life, or it is living water. And it is an expression for fresh water, like water from a flowing spring, as opposed to water from, say, a cistern that has been dug out. And so water that's been collected and stored in a cistern, water flowing from a spring, living water, water of life. So God's covenant mercy is being said to be life-giving, and that's the idea of living water, or water of life in that imagery. It's life-giving water. But God's covenant mercy is also said to be light-giving here as well. Light being an image of life, and also an image of knowledge. When we see that in Psalm 4:7, Psalm 18:28, actually Proverbs 10:11, and some other Proverbs references as well. And you look forward a little bit in the Psalms, Psalm 49 and verse number 19, it is there the wicked dead that have no more light, or they see no more light. In other words, they are cut off from God's covenant. Then we come to verses 10 to 12, and that's the prayer that ends this psalm. And it is a prayer for God's continued covenant mercy. Now, you notice that the prayer asks or petitions God for his hesed to be continued to them that know thee. And that word for know, when it is used speaking of God and people, so either spoken of God as knowing this people, or this people as knowing God, typically when it is used that way, it indicates a loving knowledge, and it indicates a covenantal relationship between the two. So he's asking him to continue his covenant mercy unto them that love you, unto them that are in covenant relationship with you. So his righteousness, that is also asked to continue the upright in heart, his righteousness is his faithfulness to his word on behalf of the upright in heart. So it's asking God to continue his covenant mercy and to continue his righteousness to the upright in heart. In other words, that God's going to keep his word, that he's going to perform all of the words that he has spoken for those that trust in him. The upright in heart is a phrase we've seen used in Psalm 7:10, Psalm 11:2, Psalm 33:1. It's descriptive of those who trust in God and who experience his salvation, the upright in heart. Now, we do get to the part of the psalm that is similar to a lament. We have a sort of a crisis complaint in verse number 11. And the crisis would be that the upright need delivered from the foot of pride and the hand of the wicked, those things that are against them. Now, this is also words that are using imagery. Foot and hand are aggressive. They are combative terms. They are describing a forcible oppression, possibly even a militaristic type of force or violence that is being used. So they certainly suggest the righteous or the upright in heart, those that love God, suffering at the hands and the feet of the wicked. And in verse 12 gives us this meditation on the end, destination, or the outcome of the way for the wicked. It says they'll be fallen, or they are fallen, they'll be cast down, and they're not able to rise. So this is a description of the future judgment in its finality. They refused the fear of the Lord. They refused His wisdom, and so they are taken in His judgment, as Proverbs says, without remedy. All right, let's go to interpretation. What does Psalm 36 teach? Well, Psalm 36 teaches the folly of the wicked. In other words, we're given a very clear picture of the wicked going their own way. So their own pride blinds them to their sins as well as to God's goodness. They can't rightly see either of those things. They don't see their own sinfulness rightly, and they don't see God's goodness, even His care. Part of the aspect of creation psalms praising God for His care of His creation is the aspect that there is there's goodness of God that's extended to all on His creation. We experience believers and unbelievers alike, even as Jesus said, the sun rises on the evil and on the good, and the rain comes on the just and the unjust and what have you. So the God as a creator and as a governor of His creation extends His goodness continually to all of His creation. But the wicked are blinded in their pride to their own sin and to God's goodness. Their counsel comes from their own hearts. It comes from their own hearts, or it comes from others like them, which we've seen the danger of in Psalm number 1. Their path is also shown here as being a path that's moving along a course of evil. There is a downward progression. Folly hardens into determined wickedness. So in other words, as the wicked are being described here, as they progress further in their hardened wickedness, these are not just mistakes. These aren't just missteps that, you know, had a moment of weakness and you know, miscalculated or what have you. No, these are determined wickedness. They are calculated and planned works of evil, as it says, devised upon their bed. It makes us think of other descriptions, like before in the time of Noah, before the flood, and how that the thoughts on the hearts of men, it said, was only evil continually, so consumed with devising and plotting wickedness. But they began astray by refusing the fear of the Lord. They had no proper fear of God or His judgment, and that sets them on this course. Their pride ultimately deceives them that they are wiser than God, that they know better than He, that they know more than His word. They're convinced that they're right. They're convinced of their strength, and so they're not afraid of God's just judgment. Psalm 36 also teaches the course of this present evil world for the upright who trust in God. Well, when we look at this psalm, we see that the wicked have an upper hand. And that's something that actually is explored in much fuller in psalms to come, even in the next psalm. But even in other psalms, it's something explored like in the book of Job, why is it that the wicked seem to be prospering? And all their lying and cheating and stealing, and they seem to come out on top. And they oppress and they do violence against those who are trusting in God and waiting patiently for Him. So David's prayer in verse 11 refers to this seeming upper hand that the wicked have. And obviously then, this is a source of suffering for the righteous. There are a number of afflictions that fall on us, all due ultimately to sin. But certainly there's a category of those afflictions that come under oppressions and injustices and persecutions, even martyrdom, that comes upon the righteous. Well, this present evil world is not pursuing righteousness. We have this contrast in Psalm 36 that shows us the way of the wicked. What is their thoughts? It's deceit. It's lies. It's arrogance. It's flattery. It's a devising of evil. It is a violence against the righteous. And then the contrast is God. Well, God is the one who keeps covenant mercy. God is the one who keeps His word. God is righteous. God is just. God is true. God is good. Well, this world, this present evil world, it's not pursuing righteousness. It's not pursuing justice. It's not pursuing goodness or truth or beauty in any way, no matter what they may claim or the way that they posture themselves. So life in this present evil world for the upright is presented in this psalm, not in terms of the strength that they have and all that sort of thing, but it's presented in terms of God's activities for them. In other words, the blessing and the benefits that they receive, even in this present evil world, and obviously much more in that is to come. So the upright are contrasted with the wicked in this psalm. And so the upright are those that are depending on God. They are depending on wisdom from God. In other words, they're not going to trust the counsel of their own heart. They're going to walk carefully in the fear of the Lord. They're going to heed His wisdom. They're also going to depend on God for every good thing. And even looking out at the present evil world, they still yet discern the goodness of God, because they trust in Him and they trust in His wisdom. All right, so Psalm 36 then teaches the redemption of the world and the judgment of the wicked, and so it gives us the messianic hope. Obviously, there's strong ties with the servant of Yahweh setting up David as the anointed servant who is the suffering servant in this present evil world, praying for deliverance and confident of that deliverance to come. Also, God's house in this psalm is pictured as a place of hospitality and a place of complete supply. So we get this feast imagery that we have seen associated with the Messiah and His kingdom already in psalms like Psalm 22, 23, 24, and 27. So we get this same imagery that comes, but it's not just the feast imagery. It's also joined with the judgment of the wicked, which we see referenced at the end of verse number 12, but we read in Psalm 2 is in connection with the coming of the Messiah, of the anointed Son King installed on the holy hill of Zion. So this psalm does in that sense then reflect a prophetic psalm. So it's very appropriate that it began as an oracle. All right, applications. I have two of these applications for us modern readers. Number one, understanding Psalm 36 certainly warns us against pride, the dangers of pride. Pride is deceptive and blinding. and we do not walk in the good and right way when we walk in pride. It leads to overlooking sin, and we're told ultimately that pride leads to falling and not rising again. So a very sober warning of pride, against pride. Number two, understanding Psalm 36 gives us the wisdom view of the world. This is exactly the kind of worldview that you're going to get reading the book of Ecclesiastes, for instance, or the book of Proverbs, for that matter. The righteous who go in the way of wisdom are not going in the popular way. The righteous can't expect to go in the way of wisdom, the way of righteousness, the way of life, and to be applauded by the world for doing so. The righteous actually, in other words, seeking to live uprightly in this world, seeking to walk in the way of righteousness, the way of wisdom, doing good, hating evil, seems to put us at a disadvantage in this world. It seems to open us up and make us vulnerable to be easily oppressed and easily taken advantage of. But Psalm 36 reassures us that God's covenant love is unfailing, and His purposes for all creation will be fulfilled regardless of what the news media or secular media or anyone else in the world has to say. And so this psalm is written to give us that sort of confidence of God's faithfulness to His own word, and that is our security and our deliverance. And we will come to this feast in His house, all those who trust in Him.